Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of August. Pakistanis filled the streets on Tuesday of this week to celebrate the 60th anniversary of their country's independence. The country, of course, a part of a unified India under British rule until 1947. And India was declared an independent state today, 60 years ago. We'll talk about the state of Pakistan the first hour of our program. And our guest says that there is a lopsided civil-military equation that needs to be worked out here so that the number of poor people, the level of inequality, and the effectiveness of social welfare delivery can be improved. He also says that Pakistan's decline into chaos is far from inevitable. We'll, of course, be looking at the challenge that Pakistan faces, and that's Islamic militancy on its own soil. We'll look at those safe havens that al-Qaeda and the Taliban have carved out in areas near Afghanistan and what Pakistan does about that. We'll look at the leadership of Pakistan and many other issues and welcome your phone calls as well. We're happy to have as our guest this hour Moeed Youssef. Moeed is a special guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and is also the director of strategic studies at the Strategic and Economic Policy Research, which is a premier research outfit in Pakistan. He deals with Pakistan's strategic and political economy, but also has a broader understanding of the country because that's his homeland. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hi, Moeed. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this lopsided civil-military equation in Pakistan right now. How lopsided is it? Why is it lopsided?
Well, I think the answer goes to historical roots. Pakistan, was born, as you mentioned, 60 years ago, divided out of United India, and there was an inherent paranoia vis-a-vis the Indians. Pakistanis always, the strategic elite has taken the security discourse ahead of any development or socioeconomic issues in the country, which has then led the military to be a significant part of politics, but has also diverted a lot of resources towards a strong military, which is seen as necessary by this elite to guard Pakistan's territorial integrity. Mm-hmm. So I think it stems out of that.
And what about the lack of strength of the civil institutions?
Absolutely. I mean, the debate can be twisted anyways. The civilians would argue that it's the military's dominance which hasn't allowed the political enclave to develop. There's no continuity in the political setup, and the reason for that is military predominance and the predominance of this sort of territorial mindset of the Pakistani strategic elite. On the other hand, though, the 15 to 20 years of civil rule that Pakistan has had has been marked by stark incompetence and corruption of the civilian leaders. Mm-hmm. So I think the problem lies on both sides. But the real issue is a lack of truce. There is no understanding between the civil and the military leadership. In fact, I think there's a high level of mistrust which stems out of this equation.
So how does that change?
That's a million-dollar question, but I think it's a long-term process. The card of democracy that is held up by the West a lot of times as the magic wand, I don't think is going to work in Pakistan because, as I said, the civil-military equation comes out of structural anomalies. It comes out of the thinking of the elite rather than any sort of, issue which is lying at the heart of vested interests or personal interests. So it's going to be a long drawn-out process where the military and the civilians would have to come to some agreement of power sharing in the interim period. And then over a period of time, the military will have to systematically pull out of politics. It can't happen overnight. In fact, I've argued that it's dangerous if it happens overnight because the military is about the only strong and staffed and functioned institution in the country at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about these elections that are coming up that Musharraf was pointing to again in 2008. These are going to be free and open elections. Could the military be removed from power?
Well, these are parliamentary elections, so the military has nothing to do with it per se. Constitutionally, the military cannot be in power in Pakistan. It's a parliamentary democracy. So Musharraf's own fate does not lie on these elections. These elections will decide who the next head of government in terms of being the prime minister is, who's going to be the cabinet. But Musharraf's re-election himself is going to be through these assemblies. The parliament is going to elect the president. So these elections, in essence, are what Musharraf is looking at is whether he can find an amenable civilian partner to run the country with him for the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of him? What do you think of Musharraf?
Well, I think he was a leader who promised much for Pakistan when he came in and has progressively sort of changed himself into being just another political leader rather than a ruler who was looking towards Pakistan's long-term interests. I think he did some major improvements were made in the economic sector, the U-turn on the Taliban and the Kashmir policies. These are major achievements for Musharraf. But as time has gone on, I think his biggest shortcoming has been that he's tried to hold on to power whichever way he can, and he continues to push for that. And I think now it has gotten to the stage where it's dangerous for the country if he doesn't allow the civilian leadership to come into its own and come up with or without him. But they need space.
And if there were to be more peace between India and Pakistan, would this allow the military to not have to continue to be as strong? And I guess the second part of the question is, what about Kashmir? What about trying to put together a peace process between those two countries?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question and a critical one for Pakistan. Unfortunately, the imminence of threat from the extremists in the western half of Pakistan has taken away some of the focus from India. But at the end of the day, it's the Pakistan-India equation that will determine Pakistan's future as well as Pakistan's civil-military equation. I think it's not correct to assume, like some have, that the military wants conflict with India to keep itself strong. I think Musharraf's tenure has shown that he's shown immense flexibility on Kashmir, and he's tried to have a breakthrough on the front. But Kashmir is, again, a very complex issue where there are no short-term solutions. And I think the way that the two countries are moving now in the peace process, which is to delay the final solution, find a way in which the Kashmiri life of the citizens can come back to normalcy, declare the LOC a soft border, I think these are all positive movements which could lead to the only realistic answer in the short term, and that is to defer the final solution and let people live their lives.
Well, you tell us about the challenge that Musharraf faces, and I'm interested in this historical perspective as well, which you cite in the recent article you wrote. This challenge of Islamic militancy on its own soil, al-Qaeda, the Taliban, who have safe havens in the area near Pakistan, and you talk about this as having historical explanations.
Yes. There are two things there. First, you've got to understand that these tribal areas were always out of the purview of the complete writ of the state. They were more or less autonomous areas where the military, where the central government didn't intrude unless it had to. And this happened in the British times, this happened in the Afghan times. This is one historical fact that one must remember. And the reason, the importance of this is that now suddenly when the military goes in, where the government tries to establish its writ on people who've not been governed by Islamabad for years, they're finding it difficult to sort of understand and come to terms with it. The other aspect of this is that the Pakistani state itself has used extremism or the Taliban in the past as a strategic tool vis-a-vis India. They've used these people in their asymmetric warfare doctrine, at least supporting them morally. And there is enough literature to suggest that actively as well in the Indian insurgency. And from there stems almost a complacency in the mind of the Pakistani leadership. Because they've had ties with these people, because they've managed these people over the years, then they're complacent about the fact that, the threat is not necessarily on the Pakistani state per se. but it still continues to look outward. And one other point I would like to make is one has to understand that the most important historical context probably is that the phenomena of extremism and Talibanization came out of the Afghan jihad in the 1980s, when the CIA and the Pakistani intelligence services were supporting these mujahideen against the Soviets. And that really started this cycle of extremism and the state using extremism to its advantages. Mm-hmm. And it continues to this day.
Hmm. And what do you think? What do the people in Pakistan think? That's you can't answer a general question like that. But what does Musharraf think? And what would be the drawbacks or the strengths of the United States moving in to rule out the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in this part of Pakistan?
Well, I think it'll be a complete disaster if you want to talk about it analytically. I've talked to the leadership in Pakistan, and they've completely dismissed this notion as unrealistic. But the fact of the matter is you have to understand the context. The American policy seems to be going wrong in the fact that they want quick fix, immediate solutions. And frankly, there is no immediate solution. Mm. If you look at the classic counterinsurgency, you've got to apply military force, but then you've also got to use political and socioeconomic tools. And peace comes about, you know, anywhere upwards of a decade. So if one is looking for quick, you know, solutions within a year or two, the military option, heavy-handed firepower, artillery use of military is the only realistic possibility. But while it might be viable for the Americans to talk about it, for Pakistan to go out after its own population in a heavy-handed manner could have catastrophic repercussions for the state itself. Hmm. And I think what we've got to balance out here is short-term interests versus the long-term future of both American interests and Pakistan as a state. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the disconnect lies.
Yeah. But what about internally within Pakistan? What about this threat from Islamic militancy wanting to take over the government of Pakistan?
In some ways, I think the threat is exaggerated. Mm. There is no real threat at the moment of a takeover by the Islamists. There are strong buffers that exist within the Pakistani society. The Islamists have no support as such among the Pakistani masses. There's a strong secular military in place. So the buffers are there. But the fact of the matter is, as I said earlier, the Pakistani leadership still remains complacent. And that, in some ways, is dangerous. The Red Mosque incident about 2 to 3 weeks ago showed that these militants are no longer partners to the state. And they have their own agendas where they're willing to take on the state to an extreme level. And in that sense, I think this is time that the Pakistanis realize that there is no longer a possibility of tolerating such cadres within the territory. Having said that, though, the answer, the leap that people, all of us in America want to make is to suggest that, okay, now we should go after them militarily, is almost untenable for the Pakistanis to think in those terms. Mm-hmm. So it will have to be a mixture of military and socioeconomic sort of policies which will be applied there, and gains are going to be coming over the long run.
Mm-hmm. Mohid, before we go to phone calls, tell me a little bit about your life in Pakistan. Where were you born, where you've been educated, how you left the country, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. I'm actually from the city of Lahore, which is the central eastern part of Pakistan and borders India. I had my high schooling in Pakistan in one of the sort of premier urban institutions. And then I've got my undergraduate degree from Georgia in the U.S. and then a graduate degree from Boston University as well. And now I'm currently at the Brookings for a short time. And I had a strategic studies unit in one of Pakistan's research organizations in Islamabad.
So would you be in any way consulting with, or would the government in Pakistan, the military or the civil institutions, be interested in your thoughts about all of this? Should they consult with you?
Absolutely. I mean, the one unfortunate part about this field in Pakistan is that there's so few of us who have expertise. So, you know, we're in constant touch with people, and you'll be surprised that the Pakistani government is more than receptive to hearing expert opinion. Sometimes, you know, looking at it from an idealistic picture, we miss the compulsions that governments face, and that is why I get frustrated with the progress. Absolutely, I think there is receptiveness within the government.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Moeed Youssef, and he is now a special guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and the director of strategic studies at the Strategic and Economic Policy Research, which is a premier research outfit in Pakistan. He deals with the country's strategic and political economy concerns. And is from Pakistan, as you just heard him talk about his life there. Pakistan turning 60 on Tuesday of this week. We're looking at the history of the country, and we're looking at the current concerns. And I think a major theme of this hour is what our guest says is a lopsided civil-military equation. So take us where you want. The leadership of Musharraf, this lopsided arrangement between the civil and the military parts of government, the relationship with India, et cetera. 1-800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, this is a really neat thing. It's called book crossing, and what you do is you leave a book somewhere. Where you leave it may be important for somebody to find. And it is tagged and tracked as it journeys through its life, which can take it from Milwaukee to Green Bay to New York to London to Seoul to wherever. It's just a terrific thing. Talk about ideas. This is an idea. And it's growing. All right, let's go to phone calls now. Ooh, our phone lines are all busy. 800-486-8655. Moeed Youssef is our guest, and we go to Mike from Milwaukee first. Hello, Mike.
Oh, hi. I have a question about the nature of the Pakistani Muslims. I understand India has the largest Muslim population outside of the Middle East. And India and Pakistan, as you know, were one country at one time. What is it about, and in fact, I understand India might even have a Muslim president or a Muslim prime minister. So I'm wondering, what is it, is there something different about the India Muslims and the Pakistani Muslims, or is the real difference in the India Sikhs, who might be more open-minded? Because Pakistan has not seemed to be able to consistently rule itself as a democratic country the way India has. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. I think it's a very complex question in some ways. To answer it in plain words, no, there is no fundamental difference between the Muslims in Pakistan and the Muslims in India. If you go back to partition in 1947, there was mass migration of the Muslims of India to Pakistan. And the non-Muslims or majority Hindus to India. But a number of Muslims who were either very poor and didn't have the means to migrate or did not wish to migrate were left over in India. And that is where the two populations, Muslim populations, come from. As far as the question of Pakistani Muslims, I think majority of the Pakistani Muslims and Indian Muslims are inherently conservative, yet very much anti-extremist. So religion is a very important thing in both these countries, but there's no connection to extremism as such. The piety and extremism are looked at as two completely different notions. In fact, Pakistani Muslims and Indian Muslims abhor extremism to a great extent. As far as the democratic polity is concerned, I think the answer lies somewhere else. And again, that is because, as I mentioned, Pakistan is an inherently paranoid, weaker state next to an adversary, which is much larger in terms of size, strength. And the Pakistani strategic elite has always crafted the discourse, the national discourse, in terms of territory and territorial integrity. And that, I think, brings in the military into politics rather than what the Pakistani Muslims per se believe in. Or the difference between Pakistani Muslims or Pakistani Indians.
Mm-hmm. And to get back to religion for a moment, when you talk about the Muslims being conservative and mention piety, do you want to go beyond that? You're equating piety with conservatism. Is there more than that?
No, I think religion for Pakistani Muslims and for Muslims largely is a personal matter. Where extremism flows from is a perverted sort of version of Islam that is being indoctrinated by a select few mm-hmm. in certain parts of the world. But if you would talk to an average Pakistani on the street, he would clearly tell you that that is not what Islam represents, and you would hear a very negative sentiment about extremism and the relationship with Islam. So I think most of the Muslims, to answer your question, 99%, I would say, completely take religion as a personal matter, which doesn't go beyond conservatism.
We go to Bob next from Darlington. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Bob.
And good morning to your guest.
Hey.
I was wondering when Pakistan has a large open election for top leadership, I wonder how Benazir Bhutto will do with that.
Okay. Thank you. I think Benazir Bhutto's party has been consistently the most popular civilian outfit in Pakistan since the late 80s. And if one were to have a free and fair election, my guess is that she would come back to power. Now, the question is, with rumors of a Musharraf-Benazir deal, which are in the offing, you might find a tenuous sort of coalition government in which Benazir has a large share. But in all likelihood, I think she's going to have a strong role in the next government post-2008.
Oh, yeah. Sounds good.
Thanks, Bob, for your call. We go to Dave next, and we have a couple lines open. If you've been trying to get through to us, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning. I guess I just want to make a comment. Your guest is talking about, you know, the majority of a good, you know, overall percentage of the Pakistani people are not extremists. But I believe that there's a portion of that country, Waziristan, somewhere up by the Afghan border, where it is completely false. And I will say that I think I can say that if there's a horrific attack on the United States of America, and it originated from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, and they are in Pakistan, that I would say 99% of the United States of America is going to back our country, going to your country, and taking care of that area. Because if you're not going to do it after attack on our country, we will do that. And if also, I do back what Barack Obama said, that if we know exactly that Osama bin Laden is in an area in Pakistan and we have a chance to take him out, I think most presidents will do that. I just want to hear his comments.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. Moeen?
Basically, I think I would agree with most of what you've said. If there is an attack which comes out of Pakistan, there will be pressure on the United States government to go in, absolutely. If they know where Osama is, I think there will be pressure or a decision to go in. I agree with that as well. What I think is missing, and what we often forget, and I'm no fan of a lot of Pakistani policies, but we often forget that there's a cardinal difference. There's a difference between external insurgencies and internal insurgencies. So you've got to equate the Pakistani government's position with, say, a position where there would be an insurgency in one of American states. And then how would the American government and American people react? So while in theoretical terms, I think your argument is perfectly logical, the problem with the Pakistani state is that it cannot go in with a short-term goal, which in 20 years from now is going to debilitate the state beyond any chance of repair. Having said that, we also have to understand, I'm a bit disappointed to hear this sentiment, and I hear it a lot. We need to look at Iraq, we need to look at Afghanistan, and we need to see that military operations in insurgencies for armies who are not trained in insurgencies, in external lands, are not always going to reap the benefits that we think they are. So, yes, the option is always on the table, but do we really want to go in and create another Iraq in a nuclear-armed Pakistan, which, at least in its own mind, is a strong enough country to withstand diplomatic pressure? So, I mean, we have to understand that, yes, short-term goals might not be achieved immediately, but we have to find ways in which by going in and by doing something which seems right at the time, we don't create a situation which cannot be taken care of later. So I think this is an important concern that we have to look at, given our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And the United States has received some criticism, perhaps justly so, for having 6 years now to find Osama bin Laden and devising a strategy that perhaps didn't target him but got the wrong place.
Yes, partly. I mean, if you understand the terrain and of that area, it's almost impossible really to hunt one person down, frankly. So, I mean, I have some sympathy for both the U.S. and the Pakistani government on this count. But just adding to the question, if Osama bin Laden were to be found and there was intelligence that he is at a particular place, I think the question of the U.S. going in would be moot because the Pakistanis have more of an interest of ensuring that he's neutralized than anybody else. So I think they would be the first ones to want to go in and do that. Where the Pakistanis are hesitant is to go in and apply brute force, because after all, they've got to live with these people in the long run, and that is almost impossible for them to imagine.
We go to more phone calls. Thanks, Dave, for your call. Our next caller is Ken from Albany. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I wondered how many billions of dollars have we given the Pakistani dictator, Munazir Bhutto was thrown out because of corruption, but are the people satisfied with how the American billions are being spent in Pakistan?
It's a very good question. Very good question. And this, my friend, is the biggest shortcoming of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. There have been over $10 billion in direct and indirect aid that has gone in. And virtually none of it has been targeted or conditionalized. You know, there are conditionalities. They do look at it. But the problem historically with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, and it goes back to 1954, has been that the masses in Pakistan have not benefited. A lot of this aid goes to the military. A lot of this aid is going directly as counter-terror proceeds, which are going towards the expenses incurred by the Pakistanis on this counter-terror strategy. There are sort of programs for education and social uplift, but they're a minor part of it. And I think that is really where both sides need to think hard and switch tables around to ensure that bulk of this benefit goes to the people of Pakistan and not just the state itself. And I think they've clearly failed thus far in this.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. You wrote recently, and let's spend a few more minutes on this, of the increasing number of poor people in Pakistan, the level of inequality, the lack of effectiveness of the social welfare delivery system. If the money had been looked after, if more money had gone to those areas, Pakistan would be in a different place perhaps, huh?
Well, I mean, of course, If more money would have been channeled into those areas, things definitely would have been better. I still don't think in the short run there would be, you know, any sort of magical progress that one could expect. But definitely things would have been looking better in some ways than they are now. The Pakistani problem at the moment is not necessarily lack of will. I mean, Pakistan has a macroeconomic growth of 7 to 8% and has had that for the past 3 years. The real issue, I think, is the economic model through which we are trying to reach the poor. The trickle-down effect that economists normally talk about hasn't been witnessed in Pakistan and in a lot of other countries. So while, you know, the economic indicators are looking good, at the micro level, the absolute number of poor is still very high. And that also is a function of the fact that Pakistan is a country of 160 million people. But if you're going to buy into the argument that poverty and economic deprivation could lead the youth to extremism, then we've got an explosive situation sometime
sure.
in the future.
Thanks so much for the call, Ken. Let's go to John from Madison next. Hi, John.
Good morning. It's a really good show, and thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you.
My question is, I've heard that the Pakistan Army is very concerned by the threat from India and that that motivates a lot of their actions and has for a long time. And what do they think the threat from India is? And thanks again, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Because your kitty wants something right now. All right, thank you.
Well, India and Pakistan, of course, go back to partition. They fought three wars. India was instrumental in actually dismembering part of Pakistan, which is now the independent country of Bangladesh. They've had recent crises. Both have nuclear weapons. And India is a much larger military which continues to threaten Pakistan through its conventional superiority. And Kashmir, of course, is an unsettled dispute and which has been at the center of most of these conflicts and crises. So I think till the Kashmir issue is resolved, and till that is subsequently followed by an atmosphere of trust building, Pakistanis will always remain worried about the Indians. I mean, if you look at it from a classic military perspective, Pakistan is justified. I mean, this is an adversary that has fought Pakistan in the past and has, you know, a much stronger military presence. But then you've also got to look at a very important fact, which at least makes me optimistic, and that is that for the first time in the past 60 years, at the moment, India, Pakistan, and the United States have the same goal, and that is to root out extremism and to ensure that Pakistan remains stable over the long run. And this has never happened before. The Indians now are more worried about a weaker Pakistan than a stable Pakistan.
Hmm.
Because a weak Pakistan could bring the threat of Islamic extremism to their very doorstep. And that tells me that both sides will remain engaged and will try and you know, maneuver in ways that the threat perception goes down.
We go next to Mary from Michigan. Hi, Mary.
Yesterday, more than 200 people were killed in Iraq. And they're described or named as Yasminis, as a pre-Islamic sect. Can you tell us about these people?
Well, I'm not an Iraq expert by any stretch of the imagination, but yes, the fact is that even in Pakistan and Iraq and in a lot of Muslim countries, there are tribes which have not really bought into the modernization agenda. So a lot of the West Pakistan, where you talk about this extremism, is also underdeveloped and has traditional ties and cultures which go back to medieval times. And this is how the Iraqi group has been described as well. Now, there is nothing inherent, no inherent connection between, you know, the culture or traditions of these people and extremism. But a lot of times they definitely do not fit into the modern sort of progressive paradigm that we view development from. And that is why they always remain on the fringes of society. And that's exactly what happened in Pakistan and in places in Iraq as well.
Well, are these indigenous people?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. They are all indigenous people. They might have migrated from, you know, other sort of countries long time back, but they've now been very much there and have their presence in those areas for a long time.
But they're not Zoroastrians, right?
No, absolutely not. They're all Muslims. At least all Pakistani ones, definitely all of them are Muslims. But just the cultural traditions are different. So I think the difference lies in culture and sort of the tribal traditions that they uphold rather than religion. I think religion is not really the disconnect here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary, for your call. We are going to take more phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. Pakistan turns 60 on Tuesday of this week, and we're looking at the state of Pakistan, looking at history, and also looking at there's so much here. We're looking at the how it's being administered. We're looking at the civil-military equation, the relationship with the United States, and the future of the country. Our guest says that Pakistan's decline into chaos is far from inevitable. Our phone number, a couple lines open if you want to join in, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, this really lovely idea. It's brook crossing, and it's a way to set brooks free. You leave one somewhere for someone to find. The book is tagged, and then you track the book as it travels, well, many of these books, all over the world. So you wonder what to do with those books you've read? Here's an answer. A very, very creative answer. That's coming up the second hour of our show. And we're talking about Pakistan this hour. Moeed Youssef is our guest. He is a special guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and is also director of strategic studies at the Strategic and Economic Policy Research, which is based in Pakistan. He deals with Pakistan's strategic and political economy concerns and also has a deep understanding of the country because it's his home country. Back to phone calls. And G is next from Madison. Hi.
Hello. I'd like to say hello to your guest. I'm from India, and I'm a Hindu, at least born a Hindu. The thing I wanted to say is that one thing that makes me very sad is this whole India-Pakistan conflict, which is basically a throwback to colonial times, and the British basically succeeded in creating this divide and keeping India and Pakistan occupied. But my specific comment was on the fact that there are more Muslims living in India than there are in Pakistan. That's the first point. And the second point is that if America makes the mistake of attacking the western parts of Pakistan, I do not think India is going to stand by and watch that. Because what would happen is that, just like in Iraq, the extremists would somehow manage to get hold of the, could manage to get hold of the nuclear weapons, and they could be used on India. And so this whole thing about Barack Obama's pie-in-the-sky idea of, you know, going into Pakistan and attacking it, I don't think it's going to happen because, and if it does happen, it would bring India into the conflict, and then ultimately that will lead to a world war.
Moeed.
Well, we all hope the scenario is not as pessimistic as you sketch it out to be, but I think I completely agree with you on the fact that Obama's threat was to me more a domestic political sort of, ploy, but it's not tenable at the moment, simply because the repercussions are going to be huge. Where I disagree, of course, is that, one, India may not sit back and watch, but the idea of an extremist getting a nuclear weapon is completely not founded. The fact is, one, technically, at the moment, there is no such technological sort of expertise that these extremists have that they can employ a nuclear weapon, even if they were to get it through some miracle. And second, you have to realize that Pakistan, because of its paranoia, one positive outcome of its being the weaker party is that it prizes its nuclear weapons to the extreme. So I don't have any sort of classified information, but I'm confident, I'm almost positive that Pakistan would have done everything it can to ensure that it doesn't lose control of its nuclear weapons. And this will be for its own interest, not for any other reason. So I don't think that is a realistic possibility. But the fact, of course, is that if America does go in, the repercussions are huge, both for the Americans and for the Indians.
I wonder whether I could make another comment?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that the extremists could easily get hold of the nuclear weapon, but in a scenario where a Western power comes into a previously colonized country, it would basically unite the Pakistanis against that. And even if they weren't extremists, they would side with the extremists. And in that scenario, it is quite possible that the extremists could get hold of nuclear weapons. I'm not saying it's a definite possibility, but that possibility is there, and that even if it's a 1% or 0.1% possibility, is dangerous enough for India not to stand by.
Well, I mean, there are two things here. First of all, you've got to understand that getting hold of a nuclear weapon doesn't do anything. If you have access to a nuclear warhead, it doesn't do anything for an immediate conflict. You have to have a deliverable capability, which simply there is no technology that can do it at the moment. So that I would count out. The other issue is that when you say that India won't sit back, I agree. But I think India's maneuvering will be diplomatic more than anything else. India will actually exert pressure on the Americans not to allow the conflict in the West to accelerate or to actually spill over into Pakistan. Militarily, even India has limited options. And that has been shown by the previous two crises in 1999 and 2001. So this notion of actually India using conventional military force to come into Pakistan and take control of the nuclear weapons is a bit outlandish. I think the answer will be that the Americans will have to be restrained because there will be pressures from all corners, including India, not to allow the conflict to spill over.
Thanks, G, so much for your call. Is it Sajib from Madison?
Yeah, my name is Saqib Mustafa. I'm also I'm a Pakistani. Dr. Muhida, I really appreciate the fact that you came on and expressed a lot of your views. I agree with a lot of your views, and it's very pleasant to see a Pakistani expressing his views like this. I do disagree with you on one thing, though, is that the economic situation of Pakistan has improved. I feel that, you know, due to 9/11 and the aid we got, it was only a temporary effort. And if you consider, if you study the macro factors in debt and then in terms of poverty and inflation, our actual growth rate has been not so high. I agree that it's 7 to 8%, but if you count in inflation and you count in other factors, it's not that high, and poverty has been increasing also. So I'd like your comment on that.
I think I never said that the economic sort of performance has been good all round. In fact, my point was that macroeconomically we're showing growth, but poverty levels in absolute terms and inequality has been very high and continues to be high. And that is a problem. The trickle-down effect that we economists talk about is not coming, or has not come as yet at least. So my point was that the inequality is actually dangerous, and it's very much there, and we need to work on that. Having said that, I also want to add that economically, you know, again, there are no miracles to be expected. So I think Pakistan could have done worse. Yes, it's artificially created because of 9/11. We got all the funding which could be used, but they did put it to use, and that is heartening to see. Where the problem lies, of course, is still the microeconomic indicators, and I completely agree with you on that.
Okay. Just one more point of view I'd like to ask is that, you know, considering the fact that there's been certain stock market crashes and there's been bank frauds and stuff which are not particularly interesting to foreign investors. What would you prescribe as, you know, a way of increasing foreign investor confidence?
I think more than, of course, the stock market as well as these frauds, they play a role. But frankly, the first question we have to answer is Pakistan's law and order situation good enough for an investor to go in? Sometimes I ask myself this question. If I were not from that country and didn't know about that country, looking at countries around Pakistan, China, India, Malaysia, would I want to invest in Pakistan? I mean, is Pakistani perception such which would make me go and put my money into that country? And inevitably, my answer is no. I think there are two fronts. One is the law and order. There's no quick solution to that, unfortunately. And I've argued, in fact, that in the short run, violence in Pakistan is going to be a positive indicator. If it is retaliation to the state taking on the extremists, it's going to be positive. That means that they're being hurt. If they're left alone, then, of course, they have no reason to create violence in the immediate term. And that then tells me that there's no short-term solution for investor confidence, because if you're going to have this kind of violence, or at least some instability within, you know, domestic ranks, then, of course, the investors are going to choose other destinations.
Having said that, of course, then on the economic front, you know, investor-friendly climates and tax regulations and all those things are still happening. And Pakistan does have a good sort of FDI track record in the past 3 or 4 years. But still, I think till you to work on the law and order situation, you're going to find it hard to actually get the kind of investment that we, that Pakistanis are hoping for.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you very much for the call. We go to Kay next from Minocqua. Hi, Kay.
Yes, I would like to ask your guest if he has read the book Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen. He is a man that who has been over in Pakistan, and he lives in the United States, really, for 10 years or more, promoting peace one school at a time. And he feels that this is the way that you decrease terrorism, not through violent action. He was a mountaineer. Have you read this?
I've actually read parts of it. I haven't read all of it. And I also would add that I completely agree with him. Absolutely.
Yes. And this is a great book for anyone to read to have a better understanding of that area. Great map in there to follow his journey. It's a great adventure, and it's uplifting.
What, so what's he doing in the schools, Kay?
He's building schools.
Oh, he's building them.
Right, over there in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And he's especially for girls. Hmm. But he works with the people. He does not dictate to them, which is why he has been such a winner there with all the people.
What's his name?
Greg Mortensen.
Greg Mortensen.
He said he works especially with girls being educated. Boys, too. He says you educate a boy and you educate an individual. You educate a girl and you educate a community.
Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you. You've been a wonderful guest there.
That's not, yes, I agree. Thanks very much for the call. Verdell is next from Milwaukee. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. My husband and I had a global home, and we've had young people from all over the world. We had two Pakistani, one from east and one from west. They still slept in the same bedroom, twin beds. And then father, when he graduated, couldn't get home because they were at war with each other. And am I wrong? East Pakistan then became Bangladesh.
Yes, that's correct.
Why is that not brought up? I mean, why isn't that name ever brought up, I wonder?
No, that's. I think if you heard when I was talking about the historical context, I did mention that one of the Pakistan-India wars led to the dismemberment of East Pakistan, which became Bangladesh. And that is one of the greatest tragedies of Pakistani history, which, you know, nobody can negate. But the context in which that occurred was much different than what we are facing today in terms of Islamic extremism. So it might not feature, you know, prominently when we discuss the extremist threat to the Pakistani state today, because that was more of a secessionist movement brought out of cultural reasons.
Yes. Well, he couldn't get home after he graduated from the university here, so he finally immigrated to Canada, where he is still living, but he goes back ever so often to his country. And but I just wondered why, you know, why I haven't heard Bangladesh on there. Do they call it Bangladesh, or is it called East Pakistan?
No, it's Bangladesh, very much Bangladesh.
It is.
Yes.
Well, thank you for the program. It's quite interesting and informational. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. And let's end, we only have about a minute left, but what is it that, because we play a role in so many things in the world, what is it the United States could do other than perhaps keeping better track of foreign aid to lift people out of poverty in Pakistan? What can we do to make the country more stable, if anything?
Well, you know, of course, the idea of socioeconomic aid is most important for the Pakistani people. But I think there are two other concerns, one Pakistan-specific and one broader. The Pakistan-specific one is that the United States has always oscillated between supporting military dictators in Pakistan and democratic governments. And it's sort of sincerity to
getting the civilian enclave back on track has been sort of dubious at best. And the Pakistani military leadership has never been the kind of totalitarian or dictatorial regime that one would, think about in Latin America or in other places. But still, the fact is that the process has been cut off at significant points when Pakistan has been moving in the right direction. So I think the United States could really help by creating a truce between the civilian and the military enclaves to allow Pakistan to get on the path of continuity. The more broader question, and this is the toughest one to answer or to address, is the notion of fighting Islamic extremism per se. The Muslims all over the world, not just Pakistan, are now actually developing resentment towards the United States policies because they view it as a target to Islam per se, mm-hmm. some inherent link between the Muslims and extremism. And I think the discourse really is what the United States needs to work on, because Muslims look at Iraq, Muslims look at Palestine, and then realize that this may be a country which is not, you know, looking after its own interests in the way that they portray, but maybe after Islam per se, which is completely misfounded. I understand that the United States is not doing that, but that's the kind of perception that is being developed.
We have to go. Thank you so much. What a great hour. Thanks, Moeed.
Thank you.
Moeed Youssef, thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Sharom Owens for on-air production here in our studios, and thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. News ahead will return on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.